we talked a lot about Bond vigilantes in our outlook back in December, and the vigilantes have shown up this year as we expected.
Yeah.
Whenever we get headlines about increased borrowing vis-a-vis a new tax and spend bill, or we're seeing, you know, some tariff recalls because of the court order, we're seeing rates react, and they're reacting quite sizably because we can tell just by the size of the candle moves. Now, you know, we're considering the real possibility of a growth slowdown, which is actually creating a bid for fixed income yields for rates and for the term premium. So how long does that last? Well, it will last this morning at least, but we don't know. Everything's changing so fast that, you know, it's really hard to keep up. It's dizzying to kind of just follow the macro environment.
It's not in the textbooks, is it? Well, Bitcoin isn't in the textbooks, generally speaking, and certainly this, what we're going through.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Well, I think just generally speaking as well, we sometimes analyze the markets as if it was always as if history existed forever. Like, the reality is this is a 100-year-old market at best, maybe even less, right? Maybe World War II. You could even say since we got off the gold standard in the 70s. So we tend to make these broad stroke assumptions, like if this was always the way. So let's analyze past data. Let's analyze current data. You know, basically when the 10-year, when you got the inverse curve, then it means a recession. Like, you know, it seems like if we're entering into a new paradigm shift, and Bitcoin as a, you know, and crypto as a technology, again, still remains to be fully adopted, but it's becoming more and more adopted. Like, the dominoes are falling in that direction. So it's a way to, you know, whether for some it's a checkout of the system, it's either a way to hold the government accountable, it's either a way to benefit from, sort of like, let them continue on their path, but we'll benefit from that because we're aware. So there's so many angles of attack.
Yeah, all of the above.
All of the above.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And so, yeah.
Yeah.
It's a really good point.
You've never seen that before.
Yeah. Awesome. You're listening to CFB Talks Digital Assets, the home of informed conversation about crypto for institutions building the future of finance, brought to you by CF Benchmarks, the world's largest crypto index provider. Hey everybody, thanks for joining us for another episode of CFB Talks Digital Assets. I'm Ken O'Delliger, head of content, and as usual, I'm joined by my colleagues, Gabe Selby, head of research, and Mark Pilipchuk, who's our research analyst. And as obviously the largest provider of regulated benchmarks to, you know, the large proportion of listed crypto ETPs, we're obviously always particularly stoked and excited when we can have one of our asset management investment management clients with us. And that's the case today. So I'm so stoked to welcome Mr. Pascal Saint-Jean of 3IQ Investment Management. Pascal, welcome aboard to the show.
Gentlemen, thank you for having me here. It's a pleasure.
So let me just explain a little bit about what the setup is for today. As suggested, 3IQ is best known as an investment management firm. Digital assets first, having listed 3IQ Bitcoin ETF in April 2021, and the world's first Ether staking ETF also in April 2021 on TSX, ETHQ, that's the ticker. And then more recently, SolQ, the Solana, amongst the first Solana staking ETFs as well, providing staking exposure. Plus, there's an XRP ETF waiting in the wings, and we're expecting that to be listed sometime in June. But just as important and exciting, many of you may not be so aware that 3IQ is also busily building an investment franchise or investment franchises in areas like managed accounts, sub-advisory, risk-managed solutions, diversified multi-management, and others, including DeFi rails as well, and bespoke solutions. The crypto investment management group for now, no less. So we are particularly looking forward to the discussion, and we're going to cover all of that. So, Pascal, I guess the place to start is actually ETFs. And, you know, so I think you most recently listed SolQ, the 3IQ Solana staking ETF. Maybe you can tell us a little bit about that as a sort of in to ETFs in general. Why did you particularly opt for SolQ after ETHQ, which is also a staking ETF?
Yes. So if you take a bit of our background, I mean, for us, ETFs were, so let's take a step back. Our firm truly believes in digital assets and its potential. And the whole mission and the creation of 3IQ was to help bring, you know, the space forward and to play a role as an asset manager. You need multiple counterparties to do that, but we want to play our role as an asset manager, not just an ETF issuer. ETFs were where we started, and we'll talk more about where we're heading as a firm. But we saw ETFs as, you know, or the beginnings of the space is how do we maximize, you know, accessibility to as many people as possible. And ETFs in our mind is a user interface towards simple access. Yes, it's not your keys, it's not your crypto. We are working with regulated counterparties and institutional counterparties, but it's making life for, you know, millions of investors worldwide, giving it an easier access and an easier gateway. And then once you, in our opinion, once you enter the space and you own something, it's like when you own a stock, you start, you know, reading more about the company, you start studying more, you know, its performance. So it's the same thing here. If you start owning a bit of Bitcoin, you start, you know, going down that journey, you start, then you say, oh, well, what's next with Web3? So why SolQ now? Why Solana now? So yeah, we had tried to launch several different assets or different tokens multiple years ago. And essentially the easiest path forward working with regulators in Canada is usually to just file, you know, something and then get feedback in return. So after we got Bitcoin and Ethereum launched, we knew that there were two key things that we wanted to then be able to create more sophisticated market structures. One was staking, super critical. Why staking? Well, because it also, yes, it gives a better return to the investor, but it's also helping to secure the network. So that was critical for us. And the other one is more broad-based exposure. Because again, you know, we could talk here all day long. Is Bitcoin going to be the king forever? Is something else going to displace it? You know, we speak within our crypto bubble. When we talk to investors worldwide, you know, you have to respect some of the questions they ask. And a lot of advisors and people who distribute, you know, a bunch of different products will ask, like my clients are asking, you know, why would I go all in one digital asset? Why not a broad-based basket, right? So these are fair questions when we leave outside the crypto bubble. And our goal, again, is to be inclusive. And so we knew we needed to also expand the different access points. And ETFs were a great point. So 3 years ago, we filed for 10 different assets, as well as staking, to see what the regulators would come back with. To our surprise, they said no to everything else but Bitcoin and Ethereum. But they said, let's talk about staking. So that was super interesting. Wow. We thought it would have been the opposite. So why Solana today? It's because it's been a three-year journey of education with the regulators. Questions that they wanted in terms of saying getting regulated futures market on the CME was part of the checkbox. And so as we were working with folks like yourselves and others to try to move that space forward, continue educating the regulators and working with the regulators in Canada to build more of a playbook and a roadmap instead of a one-at-a-time exemption, we finally got that this year. So we got staking approved 2 years ago. We got a clear roadmap approved this year, whereas before it was asset by asset. So now we know what it takes to launch ETFs. And so we're now on that path, you know, I guess 4 years after our original launch is now where you're going to be seeing 3iQ launch a whole bunch of other liquid products in the Canadian market.
Thanks, Pascal, for coming on the podcast. I think it'd be beneficial for the audience to kind of break down the investment environment in Canada versus the US. For example, in the US, staking is not allowed in ETFs currently. This is something that we believe is low-hanging fruit for 2025 to ultimately have that green lit along with in-kind create redeem. But maybe walk us through, how does that staking process work in for example, the Solana or ETFs? What percentage of the fund is staked? Who are some of your partners that you're working with? And how are things, you know, being paid out in terms of rewards?
Yeah. So when the conversation started, the way the Canadian regulatory framework functions is it's at the provincial level. So essentially at the state level, which is a little strange sometimes. But once one enters, if one of the big guys says yes, usually there's a passporting function. And so we're based out of Ontario. And so our regulator is the Ontario Securities Commission, which is the largest regulator in Canada. And usually if the OSC approves, you tend to get a passporting effect. Whereas if you work in another province, you may not get the passporting effect because ultimately the OSC is the main regulator. So, you know, we've worked with them for multiple years since our original launch. And so they know that when they say yes to something, we're right back with a different request. Right. And so for us, staking was critical. And the way the regulators in Canada wanted to function is to say, let's find a way to regulate digital assets within existing liquid, you know, regulation, which is called 81102, which is the Securities Act here in Canada for liquid ETFs for retail. And then there are other regulations for accredited investors, et cetera. And so 81-102 has a very specific list of criteria in terms of percentage of things that could be lent out, leverage, things of that nature. And so as we started talking about staking and educating the technology side, and then explaining to them how we would manage the risk. In other words, you know, one of their conditions was to stake out of cold storage, you know, in terms of liquidity management for redemptions, how would that be managed? 81-102 clearly states that, you know, the fund is not allowed to hold derivatives. So, you know, we could argue if it's a derivative or not, but we weren't allowed to hold liquid staking tokens, things of that nature. And so phase one, step one in Ethereum was a smaller percentage staked. So we started with below 50% just to prove that the methodology worked. And we originally worked with Coinbase Cloud and basically managed validators that were specific to 3iQ. So one of the other things that they wanted to see was non-commingling of assets. So we couldn't go commingling with other people. So basically 3iQ's ETHQ fund essentially has, you know, hundreds of validators for every 32 ETH managed through Coinbase Cloud. And so the regulator could see that, you know, those were our validators, our assets, all linked to the fund, out of cold storage, not commingled. So those were the things where it started. And then from there, you know, having a conversation on liquidity management and things of that nature. So at that point, they're open. And so you're going to see innovations coming from 3iQ. I can't fully open the kimono because it's our competitive edge, but you're going to see our funds going beyond 50%. Our target, our goal, it's not there today, but our goal is to be 90% plus. And so that means that you need to adapt, you know, to, you know, modern technology, whether it's what's happening with certain custodians or liquid tokens or new technologies. For example, the Pectra upgrade had a big impact on the ability to unbond in a more realistic fashion than having to, you know, then completely remove a validator on or off. We were the first to test some of the tokenized validator concepts with Nordstake and others. And so we've been at the forefront of innovation, playing the role of asset management with all these technology providers for years since that launch. Whereas everyone else is primarily just an asset manager who says, hey, I can launch a crypto fund. We are crypto native. We understand the technology and we are connected within this ecosystem. And so we've been hammering away at R&D for years, and all that is going to be coming live this year for 3iQ. And so our product, which is already leading, is going to be leading even more. And so how does that function when the regulators say you can't hold liquid tokens? It means we have to obfuscate how it works, which means things have to move down at the custodian level, right? So the technology has to function there. So that's not happening at the fund level, it's happening at the custodian level. And I think the work we've done there will benefit also US issuers.
Yeah, it seems like you guys are paving the way in that sense.
Yeah.
When it comes to staking too, I guess it's got like a couple of things that could be of appeal to investors. First, we have the yield component. So you now have access to the total return of Ethereum, yep, which has kind of been a headwind, I think, for some of the funds we've seen in the US. Totally. We haven't really seen them pick up as much as Bitcoin. But there's also that economic security aspect of it, where they're able to take their assets and they're able to secure the network. Is that something that you're seeing that people find appealing, or is it really just the yield component that they're looking for?
It's both, right? So I love that you brought that up, because that was a very critical point. Like I said, for us, it's about moving the space forward and everything we invest in. Yes, it's about designing investable products and solutions that benefit investors and of course shareholders, but also the ecosystem. And so in our view, if ETFs were going to become the gateway to mass adoption to start, which they're kind of proving to be that case, especially since the US launched theirs as well. So US, Canada, Hong Kong, you have the ETPs in Europe. And so all of a sudden now you have global adoption at the ETP ETF level. And so on our point of view, taking the battle to get staking approved was critical, because as more and more networks became proof of stake, if you're relying on a small group of individuals who know how to buy it on their own, who know how to stake it on their own, things of that nature, then you were going to get not as resilient network. And therefore, institutions may not develop on top of it, right? So if Ethereum and Solana and others, right, are not institutionally backed by large sums of dollars that stake and protect the network, then you may say, you know what, I'm not going to jump. If you're a Deutsche Bank or if you're a JP Morgan or a Scotia Bank in Canada, you may not jump towards developing on chain thinking it's not secure. So proof of stake, as powerful as it is to lowering the cost of energy and basically creating a higher speed, a higher throughput, it is 100% reliant on people staking their assets for the security. So as an issuer and as an asset manager, we thought that was uber critical. And that was a big part as to why we took that that battle to get staking approved.
Yeah. I mean, we could just stick on ETFs and the infrastructure, the network requirements and prerequisites of getting this thing to work with crypto for the entire program. But, you know, we will move on. But I do want to double back to one thing you mentioned, Pascal. The prohibition on liquid staking within these funds, which you've devised a solution to, as you described, at the custodial level. Now, in terms of that solution, clearly you sound like you're pleased with it, it's satisfactory. But what is your stance towards that term prohibition? If you don't mind me giving it that strong term, I mean, I don't know how the rule is structured. But what is your stance towards it? Is it sort of like it slightly defeats the object? And also, do you believe that it's like many things in regulations, or certainly crypto regulations, it may be something that is porous over time and that eventually is allowed to stand aside? Well, what is your general view on it?
So I think this will help blend in our sort of the DeFi or the future of the space conversation. So as a technologist, right? So my career has been primarily in disruptive tech. People underestimate the problems that could be solved through technology, right? So this is a technology, right? Let's just call it what it is. So now we had, you know, for example, primarily Ethereum had liquidity or unbonding challenges, and all of a sudden it wasn't designed with the purpose of being wrapped in an ETF. And so now you got all these solutions that were designed to help solve that problem of an ETF. But the reality is, through network upgrades, right, like Pectra and other things, in my opinion, within 18 months, liquidity, you know, if chains don't build their bonding on bonding to meet issuer needs, they're not going to gain traction in the ETP ETF market, and therefore they won't become an institutional chain, and therefore so on and so forth. You get the cascading effect. So but I believe the foundations, and we saw that with Solana, which is why, you know, we've been seeing great success at the institutional front, is because we've been able to stake a higher amount of our Solana ETF and turn it more into an institutional and retail accessible ETF, is because they designed, you know, from the get-go to make the whole staking process and the securing of the network a little easier to use for the entire ecosystem. So my opinion is liquid staking tokens or protocols will be great for DeFi. Let's say you want to wrap your ETH or even wrap your Solar, like for example, like a Mary, and basically go into DeFi, continue earning your staking rewards while then using that as collateral or using it as a means to interact on DeFi. Huge use case once adoption is there, right? As a solution to solve the problems with the ETFs, I think there's a race to build something that may be obsolete or not needed in 2 years.
That's our
take.
Yeah, we know that you've been open that the next fund is very likely to be an XRP ETF. I mean, I realize that, you know, like all regulators and regulatory regimes around the world, there's a certain amount of discretion required when you're dealing with something that hasn't necessarily been approved. If you could talk in general terms about what prompted you guys to move towards XRP as your next fund, and, you know, what is your general sort of outlook for it as well. I'm fully cognizant that it's we don't necessarily have a launch date, but you have suggested that it's imminent.
We have a prospectus out, so you could definitely, you are allowed to share what's in the prospectus. Yeah. I'm not, sure. Okay?
Yeah. But okay.
There's a prospectus out, and if you have information on the prospectus, you can share it here, and I could comment against that. So I'm trying to be, pro compliance here, right? So now, with that being said, let's talk about the roadmap that we talked about earlier. Working with the regulators over the past few years, they came out with a roadmap, but fundamentally, what the roadmap says is if there's a regulated futures market, then we are allowed to launch that ETF. The reason being was mostly for hedging purposes for market makers. Now, some of the market makers in Canada are starting to position themselves to be able to hedge in spot, but right now they're not, right? So that may be a need that gets removed in the coming year or two, who knows? But for now, that was a limiting factor. So the reality is, once Solana and XRP got approved on the CME, then that was a natural roadmap for us for multiple reasons. Just looking at the demand in our CRM in terms of people canvassing, calling 3AQ, saying, when is this coming out? When is that coming out? I could tell you Solana and XRP were the two most demanded assets.
Right.
Regardless, right? So our demand in our CRM and our education sessions was high. The next one is, you know, part of our mandate is also sub-advisory and to bring in other asset managers and banks and other large institutions into the space, both as an allocator, but also as a product provider. So in our view was quite clear. It was cover your job. Yeah, you know, the old you never got fired for hiring Microsoft type of thing, right? Well, you know, before this year, it used to be you'll never get fired if you don't do crypto. So just stay away from it. Now it's, you know, it's complete opposite. Everyone needs a crypto strategy. This was part of our opinion when I was developing the next 5-year roadmap and from a strategic roadmap. I'm like, at some point, you know, I'm trying to be careful in the words, but yes, it was cover your, you know what, by needing a crypto strategy. And so as soon as Fidelity and BlackRock and others came into the space and proved that, you know, highest, you know, most successful ETF of all time, right? The IBIT ETF, all of a sudden, the folks that we were educating, it's not like if they came out of the blue, we were talking with some of their R&D team and others, but now it's the C-suite. Now it's product approval and things of that nature. And so they all want something that's a little bit different, right? Whether it's covered call products, basket products. So if you could not offer anything more than Bitcoin and ETH, it would have been very difficult to differentiate. So, you know, 3 years ago, when I said we filed for 10 different things with staking and non-staking to be able to start playing around with the levers, we are now there today. Now we have, now 4 is not a basket of 20, but it's a start. You can now do actively manage basket and allocations. You now have staking. You now have a more mature options market, futures market. You can get creative with different solutions that appeal banks, asset managers, and others looking to get into the space for their own wealth channels, for their own advisory channels, for their own retail channels, without everyone just launching a Bitcoin ETF at zero, yeah, with zero fees, right? That's not what they're looking to do. Yeah.
I love the pragmatism of the OSX. It's, you know, looking at the biggest future. I mean, clearly, why not? The biggest futures market in the world. You know, is there hedging available for this stuff?
Because we could have, you know, there were other mechanisms to hedge, right? Like market makers came to the regulators and said we could go offshore here or there, but they had various, but at least they gave us, we rather a set of rules to play with.
Absolutely.
And then continue to evolve than where we were before, which was exemptive relief for everything, which is difficult to build a roadmap as a company when everything is exemptive relief.
And North American regulators around the world are learning from that example.
Yeah. You
know? Yeah. Now might be a good time to turn the page here and talk a little bit about institutional adoption.
Sure.
So as we sit here today, the current administration just revoked the restriction that barred Americans to invest in a digital asset ETPs in their 401ks or products like that. So that's going to be a big, I would call it an institutional well. If you think of wells like, you know, liquidity wells or oil wells in Texas, you know, there's these big pools and small pools, and we just unlocked a major pool here. I think it's most estimates run around $9 trillion of a new well that's being tapped. Perhaps maybe you can walk us through how the Canadian system works. I know that you all have pensions. What's the latest, you know, coming from that cohort? Are there any hesitations that you're hearing from asset allocators in that space? And how do you think that's going to kind of play out in the next 3 to 6 months to over a year?
100%. So we've been very involved in all of the above. So the Canadian system, we have an RRSP, which is a bit like your 401k, and a tax-free savings account, which is a little bit more like your Roth IRA. Okay. Our products qualify for both. So that was a big advantage of wrapping things in an ETF, is it made it tax efficient for growth, for retail and for wealth. So what we saw when we first launched, you know, 4 years ago was, you know, you have different permissions. Let's call it the wealth channels, okay, which in Canada is 85% controlled by the banks. So the big five have fully vertically integrated, you know, banks and wealth channels as well. There are a few large independent asset managers and a few large wealth managers, but primarily the banks control all of that. And so, you know, if the client was requesting access to digital, some advisors had the right to invest if it came from the client, right? Most of them had no discretionary rights, and some had full-on blockage. In other words, even if the client asked for it, no bueno. Oh, well. You got to go somewhere else. Open up.
Yeah.
You know, funny enough though, the bank's direct investor platforms allowed it. So basically, if you were with a bank and you weren't allowed to advise your client, you could say go open a self-directed account at the same bank and go buy it there. Again, it's just, you're just doing U-turns, right? And yeah. and taking
yeah.
side roads to get to the same conclusion. Now, that was 4 years ago. During the last bull run, the Canadian pension, so in Canada, it's a bit like Australia, we have very concentrated large mega pensions, CPP, Caisse de Dépôt on the Quebec side, which is basically the province, like a state, a state pension fund. And then Ontario Teachers. So all these pooled funds are some of the largest in the world and very influential, like Canadian Pension Plan, Ontario Teachers, and others all have offshore representation in Singapore, in Europe, Middle East, and in the US as well. So they are global allocators and move markets when they come in with big tickets. So we had been educating them on digital assets for many years. We were passionate about it, but they didn't know where to put it in their bucket, right? It's like, I understand Bitcoin. I understand where things are going. So what bucket is this going to play in? Ah, the venture bucket. Well, the venture bucket is not, let's go buy 3XQ ETF. It's let's go invest in FTX and let's go invest in Celsius, right? This is where, unfortunately, sort of the we've seen this in other markets. It's the institutional FOMO at its best where, you know, folks like Sequoia and A16Z and others are like, well, those guys know what they're doing. So since they diligenced FTX, we could just come in. So because fundamentally, you know, our typical DDQ has like some basic questions like share your balance sheet, who's your CFO, right? And how do you custody? Those three questions, FTX fails. Like we have no CFO. We're not showing you our balance sheet. And I'm not going to tell you how we custody because it was, you know. So long story short, this all could have been avoided, right? Now, with that being said, Canadian pensions came in with quite a splash investing. I think Caisse de Dépôt took the entire bite of Celsius, the half a billion. And then Teachers came in pretty aggressively with FTX. And then literally within 60 days, the whole cascade started. And so unfortunately, they went into, let's not talk about this anymore. And that did put a black cloud at the regulatory level as well. Like at that point, FTX had put in a bid to buy a Canadian exchange. Binance was trying to enter Canada and get regulated. And so Canada just pushed everything out, denied the acquisition, denied the license. Pensions came out. And us as an asset manager all of a sudden had our hands tied behind our backs where we could not do anything really innovative besides our ETFs. And so that began our global expansion. Right. Yeah. Our US team, our offshore team, our Abu Dhabi team, our European team, and now part of a Japanese parent company called Monex. So that cascading set of challenges made for a very difficult innovative landscape. Now, fast forward to today, three main changes. The banks are exploring custody, trading services, and asset management services. This is not just me saying, of course, the institutions are coming. We are talking with them, and you will see some big news within 2025, 3IQ linked to these names. And so what I'm saying here is fact, not fiction. And so what does that mean? That means that now when a bank that controls wealth channels chooses to enter the space, they're going to train their advisor base. They're going to market to pump it through their channels. And so now, and they're going to make it discretionary if advisors want to. So that unlocks the wealth channels in Canada. That's one. So that's the allocator space. It also means that there's mass distribution. And then you start looking at baking these into macro portfolios, like what Fidelity is doing with their macro ETF, where they allocate, I think, up to 3% into Bitcoin. And so that's the banking wealth channel. So it's completely changing or in the process of changing, which will unlock a lot of capital. And the pension level is the same. We're entering a summer roadshow with, they all want to talk. Now, I don't have the data if they're looking straight up for Bitcoin, if they're looking for emerging managers and hedge funds, if they're looking for venture again, I'll have those data points this time in the fall. But the fact that they want to have conversations uber bullish. So pensions want to talk again. Family offices are allocating. You know, banks are coming in. Advisors will be trained, and sort of discretionary permissions will be given, and so that will unlock another level of opportunities and will reduce the career risk. Because if you think about the opposite, you know, which advisors is going to go and battle their parent company to allocate potentially 1% to a client's portfolio? And if it doesn't work out and the client says, well, you know, you did this for me, but the bank didn't allow it, it's career risk. It's, I don't want to be bothered golfing in the summer, so I just won't do it. It's easier to say no than to pick the battle, even if you think it's the best interest of your client. So they just won't do it. But now the tides are turning.
It's like the career risk thing is something that I've mentioned internally and I've in my discussions externally as well. It's such a big factor for wealth managers, for anyone that's an asset allocator. It kind of is, I hate to say it, but 95% of the decision-making is career risk, unless you have an individual who's very emboldened and has a lot of conviction. That's few and far between.
Yep.
So it feels like the hourglass has flipped on the career risk spectrum. So before, the career risk was, you know, it's not worth touching digital assets because, you know, it's better to fail conventionally than to risk it all, you know, unconventionally.
Yeah, yeah.
And now it's flipped and it's like, okay, the FOMO is real.
Yep.
Everyone's moving in and we're, you know, being forced, or, you know, we have to really seriously consider allocating now. And so it's just really interesting to hear that. And I think that from my perspective, sitting here in the US, the Canadian market seems to be moving faster. And because of the fact that you have four or five large banks that dominate the wealth channels, I anticipate that the adoption could come quicker through Canada right now than through the US, just because I know how long a wirehouse, a big bank, or even a smaller RIA will take to, you know, onboard and do the due diligence for these products and get them, you know, into those models or those discretionary mandates. So that's really what I'm seeing.
Yes, but when the US decides to move, it moves with tremendous weight and speed. Like when you guys say go, it's let's go, right? So here's what I tell people, right? When I share the, you know, for me, whether it was, you know, my early career on the web, open source, or early machine learning, which was the grandfather of AI, the reality was I always look at the domino effects, what dominoes need to fall. So when people come to me, friends or family or others, and saying that I miss the opportunity, right, without giving financial advice, I just say, look, yes, Bitcoin's at 100,000. Yes. Okay. So it used to be at 1,000. It used to be at 100, but let's put price aside. Banks are starting to come in. Wealth channels are not yet unlocked, right? Pensions haven't only started allocating. Like, so you just saying the institutional, you know, flows have just started.
Yeah.
When the institutions come, it trumps retail. Governments have just started. So, I mean, you know, I'll let Kathy Wood and Michael Saylor, you know, create models and numbers. But, you know, I don't think that they're crazy in some of their assumptions for the next 10 years.
Yeah. And another area that I think could be interesting to explore, be worth talking about here, is the DeFi area and some of what 3iQ is doing. So my background is in endowments and foundations, and we often had sleeves in our portfolios where we'd look for alternative beta or sources of uncorrelated strategies. And one thing that always came to mind was DeFi, some of the yields you can earn and some of the things you can do liquidity providing, if you take a little protocol risk, can definitely fit the bill in there. So could you kind of tell us a little bit about what 3iQ is looking at in that space?
So if we look at the final, so going back to the sort of five-pronged strategy of creating products that help investors, but also help move the space forward, ETFs and staking, bring people in, secure the networks, hedge funds and managed account platforms and sub-advisory with the large banks and asset managers. It's speaking the institutional language, right? It's helping them translate and create things as they understand it. So now you bring access, you bring security, you bring the big dollars. This is probably an unpopular opinion, but I share it openly because it's the biggest risk to the space. Is, look, I come from the world of tech, and technology has made big bold bets that it would transform the world. And some technologies have, and others have never lived up to their hype, right? Mm. Not saying that we're in a hype cycle, but the technology for DeFi works. You can wrap assets, you can go and do a peer-to-peer loan, we could do a peer-to-peer swap, all on DeFi. So the technology functions. So now when we look at, you know, how much transactions and how much volume is happening there, it's tiny relative to the entire ecosystem of the financial world, right? So to me, the next 5 years are going to be uber critical. Is this going to, you know, live up to its potential, particularly in the emerging markets, and disrupt other markets? Or I joke, is it going to become the Segway, where it was supposed to be like a revolutionary way of doing, you know, public transportation, and now it's like used. Look, don't get me wrong, I love riding a Segway when I do a city tour, but it's linked to like city tours, yeah, and mall cops, right? That's like, yeah, kind of like so we don't want that to happen here. We don't want, yeah, to be a meme in a world of memes in 5 years. And so,
yeah,
and so I'm not saying 3IQ is the only player that's influencing this. The technology providers of foundations, it's uber critical, but we want to play a role in that. And so what does that mean? That means that we see a world where we have to blend the two worlds. That means creating a fund and an investment strategy that is appealing to institutional capital, like you were saying, Mark, there, the yield play. But that capital is utilized to accelerate the growth and liquidity in the DeFi space. And so you're serving two purposes. You're not just going and robbing and stealing the yield and bringing it back to institutions and not care. It's deploying it in tactful ways with foundations, with projects that have momentum to help them build that flywheel growth while generating a return that is risk managed and appealing to institutions. If we could solve for that, which is what we're working on, then all of a sudden you have an institutional capital flowing in and institutional capital being utilized to promote and grow and scale DeFi. I think that's, yeah, a pretty cool role to play in the coming years.
Pascal, I want to ask you to, maybe unfairly do a bit of a double think, because one question, since I spoke with you actually, a short while ago, yeah, before this recording, that's been in my mind, it may be that your background, as you say, you're sort of like a tech background, essentially grounded, your fundamentals in that. What makes a Pascal St. John wake up one morning and say, well, you know what, I've actually got to broaden this out from just investment management, you know, the traditional view of that perspective, yeah, of that. Whereas your peers, your counterparts, doing very, very similar things, you know, wake up the same morning and say, well, I've got to double down, more ETFs, you know, maybe even outside crypto, maybe even more in the sort of traditional sort of asset classes. I guess I'm asking, what is the rationale that they're chasing that they believe is, obviously they're not going to catch up with the massive big boys that we've been discussing earlier, yep, but they still believe that they're onto a sort of track that makes sense, it's cogent and likely to be profitable. And I guess, you know, still works in the future. What is the difference there? What am I missing about what some of these other guys are doing?
Yeah. For us, we're very mission driven. Now, I'm not, yeah, I can't speak on anyone's behalf, but for us, my entire career, I've built my businesses and my teams around being very mission driven, and have an impact in what we do, right? Because if this is a pure play business, right? If we were sitting here and this is a business podcast and we were talking about what's the most efficient way of maximizing margins and scaling a business, I would not be in crypto asset management right now.
Right. I hear, right, you.
I mean, it's competitive, regulatory barriers, lots of challenges, lots of things to evolve. There are other means of just making a buck, right? Don't get me wrong. You know, you need to make money, but we're fans, sure, of the triple, sure, bottom line. So what does that mean? That means how to create something of value, you know, for shareholders, how to create an environment that's really cool and innovative for our people that want to work at 3IQ, and how do we impact sort of the evolution, you know, of humanity in general. Now, that's a big, bold mission. I'm not saying that we're changing the world, but that is our core purpose, because I'll say half the firm are already crypto millionaires. They don't, yeah, need to work at 3IQ, right? They could, yeah, just go, in Costa Rica and surf all day, right? So they're here because they, you know, the crypto space has been good to them, has been good to me, has been good to us. So how do you then link your strategy to that mission? And I've also always been a very strong, you know, realist of like, you know, don't be afraid of the truth. The truth was BlackRock's going to come in at some point. We just didn't, yeah, know that we have 6 months or 6 years at start. Don't think you're going to build a brand that will outcompete that. Now, where do we outcompete? We outcompete at the level of at the edges where it's complicated and yucky and it's trench warfare. That's also where the margins are in any business, yeah. Right? The mass market, easy to do, margin compression exists. The trench warfare, wake up every morning, you know, roll up your sleeves and figure something out. That's the fun part. That's also where the margins are.
Yeah. I knew I was onto something. I'm glad I asked.
I would like to just jump back a little bit to the institutional adoption piece, yep, and talk a little bit about some of the things that we're seeing here in the U.S., particularly with treasury strategies involving, you know, Bitcoin in particular. And that's something that's being considered not just at the corporate level, but also at the state level and even at the federal government level. Is that something that is also occurring in Canada? Do you think you're going to start to see interest for a treasury strategy to have a strategic allocation to Bitcoin as a potential either hedge for purchasing power or just, you know, a sound money vehicle to keep assets stored?
A lot of small medium businesses are doing it. Like, they're not public companies, so they're not, you know, they're not, but they are doing it. I mean, I'm part of multiple entrepreneur circles. I'm on a bunch of different boards in Canada. You know, so a lot of people are doing it. They're doing a mini micro strategy, but not the infinite money loop, right? Like, in terms of, like, you know, on the public markets and raise. Now, some, like Sol Strategies and others, have done it through the Canadian channels, and so sometimes a little bit easier to list on the venture or some smaller exchanges in Canada and then get cross-listed into the US. Now, at the government side, some cities are exploring, but I think it's going to take a while because, you know, we fought the good fight internally, because I live in our nation's capital, and I never wanted crypto to become politicized, because it was becoming, particularly during COVID and during the trucker scandal here in Canada, becoming politicized. And I don't think that ever ends well when one party says I'm pro crypto and the other party says I'm not. Mm. Then you're not growing the space. And so we did a lot of lobbying work and educational work to gain champions from all parties. And so today I would say crypto is well accepted, but just not talked about from a political perspective. So I don't foresee the government stepping in here first. Now, they may follow suit since it's happening in the US. Small businesses, yes. Canadian listed companies are using Canada as a gateway to run some of these treasury plays with the goal of cross-listing in the US. And look, Shopify is very active. You know, I mean, I think Toby's on the board of Coinbase, things of that nature. They don't have it on their balance sheet, but they're integrated. They accept crypto payments. So that could be a first mover in Canada, would be Shopify. But I'm being very, this is just me being hypothetical here. I don't have any information to say that they would, but they're active in the space. They're on the board of Coinbase. They're pro crypto. I know the guys.
Yeah, that's good stuff.
Yeah, I also wanted to jump back to just some of the pension adoption and stuff too. I know that it's previously just been in the venture sleeve that we saw Bitcoin, but one thing that we've heard here in the US from some pension managers is that it's the lack of yield that's a little bit of an issue. Now, they've been able to combat this by doing some of the basis trading in their book. Is that something that you're seeing there too? Is the yield an issue for them?
Yes. So there are some pensions who are sophisticated, who have gone down the venture route, who are also running the basis trade. We're packaging that up to make it more accessible for institutions. That's our next product coming out. And so, again, making it easy and making it tapping into more markets to get more consistent yield. Because sometimes the basis, if you're just using the ETFs, it's on or off. We're trying to make it a little more consistent. So that is of demand. One of the things, again, going back to risk managed solutions, I've done a lot of dinners with where pensions were at the table. I won't say which pension, I won't say which individual, but this is again speaking their language, and it was a little. I knew that's how they thought, but it was a little bit of a shock, and I kind of make a joke at the table. But the individual beside me was like, "Well, my real estate or private equity funds don't get marked until there's another transaction, and so it's not volatile." And I'm like, I almost spat my wine that night. I'm like, I don't know, if you were to mark your book today, I'm pretty sure, it's volatile. So, but the reality, talking about career risk, right? The fact that, yes, they're not liquid, it's long duration, but the books look stable. And in a world where they're bonused out and evaluated on performance, they're trying to find, life hacks to make that life a little bit easier. So I made the joke. I said, well, I could wrap Bitcoin in a fund and mark it once a year for you. But That joke didn't land so well, but because for them, you know, Bitcoin being, you know, real time volatile, yeah. Mark, they don't know how to handle that in their portfolio. So, you know, yield is one, but we're trying to, like, again, for us, if a pension comes in a product like a DeFi yield product or a basis trade product with the goal of having consistent low vol yield, that's, you know, yes, they may not be believers of Bitcoin, but that money coming into the space enhances liquidity, enhances adoption, and moves things in the right direction. And so for us, we just see it as, yes, maybe it's not a pure play belief, but it's only helping to grow the space. And so that's why we're creating those types of solutions as well, because we have to meet those clients where they are. And in our opinion, if anyone is afraid, I know sometimes I've been on panels lately at Consensus and in Bermuda, where some individuals were saying the Trump administration has to move fast because, you know, if they lose in 4 years and if these laws are not ingrained, mm-hmm. they could retroactively do, right. You know, that's true, maybe. But in my opinion is, if we embed this at the institutional level, there's no way the politicians are going to have the guts to unwind something if the banks are involved and the pensions are involved and other things. So to me, yes, you could battle the regulators and work with the politicians, but getting institutional adoption creates that force field that we need for the space to grow.
I think from a risk management solution standpoint, there's also the opportunity that you're going to see the options market kind of help provide a lot of strategies for certain outcomes or certain risk 100%. Metrics. So yeah, I mean, that's kind of what we're seeing here in the US. And I know that it's going to take time for, you know, these pensions or these types of institutional investors to seriously consider implementing such strategies, but certainly, you know, as this stuff becomes more and more accepted, we've already seen Bitcoin's volatility this year just trend lower and lower. I think we're at near all-time highs, while the 52-week range on Bitcoin volatility is at the lower bound. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of unique. But the fact is, yeah, there's with the return profile of Bitcoin and the way the option market prices that stuff in, there's certainly a lot of juice to squeeze out, you know, selling that or even, you know, buying some downside protection to help mitigate some of your downside risk. So I think, you know, that's another thing that could potentially be a factor going forward. And yeah, I also just wanted to say, you know, as we kind of come to the closing stage of our podcast, it might be a good time to look ahead. So maybe we could talk a little bit, you know, to the degree that you're comfortable with sharing the details of, you know, what's next for 3iQ. We've talked about some recent product launches with Solana, the staking ETF. But what's the second half of 2025 look like?
Yeah. So you mentioned another ETF that may launch at some point. So, you know, people could rewind and figure that one out. So yeah, so that's happening there. After that, our goal is to then and look, we've done great. Solana SOLQ, SOLQ has been a massive success and continues to grow. We foresee the same type of success with our next potential ETF, and then we're going more towards the commercialization of, you know, more risk managed active solutions for the pension market. So we already have a managed account, the world's first managed account. It's called QMAP. It has it's multi manager, multi strat. But we are packaging that and bring those back into different markets. So you're going to see that's already happening. But the big thing that's going to happen in the second half of 25 for us is you're going to see our names linked to some big co-brands, big white label. I mean, it'll be white label, but the news will be that 3iQ is powering it. So helping sovereign funds come in and commercialize certain things, working with some of the banks and other asset managers. So the whole sub-advisory component is going to be a big part of our new cycle post the ETF launch, our ETF launches. And then after that, we're expanding and investing in our R&D team on the DeFi side. And so you're going to start seeing some partnerships with some of the foundations and things of that nature. So super exciting 2025. Yeah. And I would say the team's incredible. Already saying, Pascal, we're already thinking 2026 with everything you got us doing here. So
brilliant. That's the way it should be. I think. Yeah. Awesome. Awesome. Absolutely amazing conversation. And yeah, we appreciate you coming to share.
Of course.
So candidly, you got to come back, unfortunately.
You've done too well. Let's, if we're ever up in Canada, let's arrange some Canadian whiskey tastings and segue rides.
Done. I got one that you'll fall in love with. It's a maple syrup whiskey. You can't go back after you have that. So yeah,
I don't think we can deal with that down here.
Yeah,
I don't think folks in Kentucky know that. So we'll import that.
Sounds good.
So our thanks to Pascal Saint-Jean, CEO of 3IQ Investment Management, a really enlightening conversation. And, you know, in many ways, I think a lot of you would have thought that you got a lot more than you bargained for with all the other stuff that 3IQ is getting involved in. This is episode 45. If you enjoyed it, we've got obviously a whole ream of others for you to dive into wherever you get your podcasts. For the rest of our content, cfbenchmarks.com is where you need to go. And we'll see you again for another episode of CFB Talks Digital Assets. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for listening to CFB Talks Digital Assets. This recording is for informational purposes only and should not be considered investment advice.
This recording is not intended to persuade or incite you to buy or sell any financial products noted within, including but not limited to exchange-traded funds, mutual funds, equities, other instruments that reference any index provided by CF Benchmarks Limited, or crypto assets. Any commentary, interviews, and discussions are opinions only and should not be considered a personalized recommendation. Please contact your financial advisor or professional before making an investment decision. Note, some of the underlying instruments cited within this recording may be restricted to certain customer categories in certain jurisdictions.